Welcome to the Holistic Plastic Surgery Show. I'm Dr. Anthony Yoon, also known as America's Holistic Plastic Surgeon. If you want to look and feel amazing, but ideally don't want to go under the knife to get there, then you, my friend, are in the right place. If you ask dermatologists and plastic surgeons which one skincare ingredient they would recommend, they would overwhelmingly say retinol. Retinol is a derivative of vitamin A, and it's been clinically shown to improve the appearance of fine lines and wrinkles, exfoliate the skin, lighten blemishes, and a whole lot more. Skincare specialists love retinol, and I do too. And if I had to pick one retinol to recommend, it would be my Yoon Beauty Retinol Moisturizer. This is the cornerstone for a youth-promoting skincare regimen for adults of all ages, because it works. My Yoon Beauty Retinol Moisturizer is made with natural and organic ingredients, it's cruelty-free, and it's gentle but powerful. It's one of the top sellers at YoonBeauty.com. If you'd like to try our Yoon Beauty Retinol Moisturizer for yourself, go to YoonBeauty.com and use the coupon code PODCAST to get 15% off your first order. We will have a link in the podcast caption below. On this week's podcast, we're going to talk all about how you can make your life bigger, bolder, and better by making simple changes in how you live your life and how you, I guess, look at life. So I'm going to be joined by my good friend, Jennifer Cohen, who is an entrepreneur, a podcaster, and a best-selling author. And she's going to give you the secrets to living a bolder, better life. But before we do that, I'd like to give a quick shout out to CB001. CB001 left a nice review of this podcast on iTunes stating, "Just what I needed. I had turned 50 and was looking for an alternative to the invasive procedures I wasn't ready for. It's one of my favorites." Thank you so much, CB001, for this nice review of the podcast on iTunes. And if you've been enjoying the podcast, if you could leave a rating or review on iTunes, it definitely helps me spread the word. And every week, I'll give a quick shout out to somebody who does. So let me go ahead and introduce my guest this week. Jennifer Cohen is an entrepreneur, podcaster, educator, and best-selling author. Her latest book, Bigger, Better, Bolder, hit the Wall Street Journal bestseller list. She's been a longtime authority in health and wellness, where she co-founded numerous companies, including No Gym Required and Hot 5, which was acquired by Weight Watchers. Jennifer is also an in-demand motivational speaker for a range of companies as well as business schools, and her TEDx talk has more than 7 million views on YouTube. Jennifer lives in Los Angeles with her husband and her two little superstars, Dylan and Sydney. I am really excited to bring this podcast to you. It's a little different than the health-related podcast that I normally do, but this is really one that's going to be to help to give you guidance in how to live your life in a bolder, bigger, and better way. I really hope you enjoy my discussion with Jennifer Cohen. Thank you so much for joining me today, Jennifer.
Thank you for having me. This is going to be so fun. I loved having you on my podcast.
So I'm really excited because I just finished your new book. It's called Bigger, Better, Bolder, Live the Life You Want, Not the Life You Get. I know already because it's the paperback is out now. So the book has been out for a good year or so, but I know it's changed a ton of lives. You've had this video on your TED Talk that went viral. All of this I find fascinating because the fact is that when you were young, your teacher told your mom that you were, quote unquote, average at best. Now, I've known you for a little while, not a long time, but a little while, and you are anything but average. How did this impact you? And having a teacher literally say something like this, which is really hurtful. I mean, if they said this about my kids, I'd be pissed. How did this then drive you and affect you as a kid and then now as an adult?
Well, that's a really good question. That's really funny because I think really what was happening was I was very distracted. I didn't love school. And so I would daydream a lot. I would think about all these other things that I like to do. And therefore I didn't test very well. But when the things I actually did like, I was hyper-focused. I think that's kind of called like ADD or something, right? But I think it kind of gave me a superpower. And I think the superpower was it taught me to use that mediocrity as a strength, not as a weakness. And part of it was having to learn how to, you know, navigate around that and really lean into things I was good at and do them really well. I learned to be exceptionally resourceful because when you're basically barely average. You know, everything was kind of a struggle for me in school. So I had to kind of figure out really fast how to navigate through. And it really increased my EQ, my emotional intelligence, my street smarts, because I had to like become friends with the smartest person in the class and use them to help me get better grades. Or it really worked in my advantage. And I also think that when things aren't handed to you and you're not exceptional at everything, you become okay with like not with failing, basically. And that failing helped me learn the quality and skill of resilience. So it made me not scared to try things. It made me not that nervous. If I try something and it didn't work and I failed, I kind of figured like, well, of course I'm going to fail. Why would I do well? So that allowed me to like become actually fearless in failing, which then really changed the trajectory of like my life, because I would go for things not caring if I got them or not. And that's how I got my best opportunities, by through failing and kind of going down the path.
One of the stories that I found interesting, because, you know, you grew up in Winnipeg, a small city in Canada. I grew up in a tiny town in the middle of Michigan and always dreamed of being more than just this skinny kid in this tiny town. And I get the sense reading your story that you're in the same situation. And you know, when I grew up, some of the people that I looked up to were the people that I saw in media. And you had an experience with one Keanu Reeves a long time ago that really impacted you. Can you tell us that story about how, as a young person, you got Keanu Reeves to come to your house and help you try to get an audition for the Canadian version of MTV?
Absolutely. That's right. So yes, that was actually a very pivotal moment in my life, that entire experience, because in that moment, it taught me, number one, you need to ask for what you want, and that being bold is way more important than being intelligent, right? Because, and also that naivety is a strength. Like, I didn't think for a second, it didn't even occur to me that he would say no. So I thought, why not? So to give you like kind of like a very abbreviated version of what happened was, I really wanted this job as this VJ for Much Music, which is the equivalent to MTV. Think of like Carson Daly, right? Like the, you know, when they were like that job. And by the way, not to date myself, but if you are somebody in your 40s or, you know, late 30s, 50s, whatever, that job was very coveted back then. Like, MTV was super cool. Remember?
Who didn't want to be a VJ? I wanted to be a VJ.
Right?
I mean,
yeah, everybody did. Like, that was the cool gig. That was the cool job to have. I was always very curious. That was kind of one of the things that kind of really assisted me in life. But I was always naturally curious, and I loved music. And I thought this was a really great gig for me. And I know, and I even knew that job was so coveted, everybody and their dog would be going after it, because they were doing a national search for the new VJ, for the new person. And so I knew, I'm like, how am I going to stand out enough where they'd actually even look at my audition tape, my demo tape? So I got it in my brain that I would have to be, it would have to be extraordinary. And then like Keanu Reeves was at the top of the top of his career, by the way, still stayed there after all these years. And he was in my small town performing some crazy, play, Hamlet. And it was like the biggest news in the world. Like, it was literally like the top of the headline on like CNN that Keanu Reeves was in Winnipeg, you know? And so I figured this is my big shot. So I told all my friends and I did all the things, and I said, I'm going to find Keanu. I'm basically going to ask him to be in my demo tape. I'll interview him, then I'll send it into, you know, Much Music, and it'll be a slam dunk. And my friends and my family all laughed at me, and they thought, God, here she goes again. Again, remember, I was fearless from failing because of my mediocrity, right? So I'm like, what's the worst that can happen? That was always a thing in my head. So one day I stood outside where I knew he would be performing, and remember, Winnipeg is really cold. It was like minus 40. And I waited for him for an hour to come out while everybody else was there. The press was there, everybody. And I made my way to him. I tugged on his jacket and I basically, you know, he looked around and he's like, well, I'm just going to give you an autograph. And I'm like, well, I don't want an autograph. That doesn't help me at all. But what does help me is if you would actually help me with this, my dream job. And he looked at me crazy. He said, well, you know, write down your number and I'll call you. And I thought to myself, like, as if he's going to call me, right? And I went back to school. I told all my friends. They all laughed at me. My mom laughed at me. My dad laughed at me. My friends laughed at me. And day one goes by, no call. Day two, day three. And then day four, the guy calls me, leaves a message on my answering machine. My mom answers the phone. And, you know, next thing you know, I'm picking up Keanu Reeves and my mom's Cutlass Supreme, taking him to my house. My mom made him lunch, and me in my amateur way, you know, like, you know, my amateur ways, I had cameras all over my house, like those little camcorders, like getting him on every angle. And I thing together. Yeah. You know what I mean? And I put the videotape together, made a demo tape, sent it in, and the rest was history. And it really did change the trajectory of my life.
So then you got the job on More, you became a VJ.
No,
and then
I did not get the job.
You parlayed that into MTV.
Actually.
I know, I'm kidding.
I know, no. I didn't even get the job. And the moral of the story is it's not even getting to the goal. It's really putting yourself through the process. You know, like I actually got really close. I became the runner up out of like 30,000 people. But, you know, I lost it. I lost out to another girl. But, you know, the reality is it wasn't even the job. It was the fact that I had the guts and the courage to even attempt it, to even try. And that's my point. That's the message. And that's why I even wrote the book, is because I think a lot of times people count themselves out before even attempting or trying for something that they want. And what I like to tell people is, even when you don't think so, even when you have the self-doubt, even when you think you can't, do it anyway. Because doing it over and over again eliminates that fear factor. And you would be really surprised, actually shocked, of what happens during that process of even making that attempt.
So this brings to mind a part of your book that I found really fun. And there's a story called the George Costanza effect. And I'm a huge Seinfeld fan. I've watched, I think, every episode. I may have missed one or two, and literally that's it. And this is an episode called The Opposite. Can you explain the George Costanza effect and actually what people can learn from it? Because some of what you're saying here and what you're encouraging people to do is
totally
to act like George Costanza.
Totally. Everybody should act like George Costanza. And the reason why I love that analogy is because George Costanza, if anyone ever watched Seinfeld, knows that he was like the loser friend, right? Like he was out of work, he was unemployed, couldn't find a girlfriend, living at home with his parents, middle age, you know, short, bald, whatever. And, you know, nothing would ever work out for him. And then one day he decided to do everything the opposite of how he always did things. And it started to actually turn around for him and actually work out for him by just starting to do things different. It's kind of like the same thing, like, you know, like it's like doing the same thing over and over again and expecting a different result. The only way to get a different result is to do something differently. And so I always say, do the George Costanza. It's called the George Costanza effect, because it's basically telling people to do the complete opposite of what they would normally naturally do to get a better result. And more often than not, you actually get way further and actually change the actual trajectory of what's happening in your life by doing so.
And so in the show, so, you know, just like you said, he was kind of a loser, no job. And then next thing you know, he works for the Yankees. He's got a girlfriend. He's friends with George Steinbrenner. And like,
exactly.
And I think there's a lot of truth to it, because, yeah, I think there's so many of us, we get into our ruts of like our daily life and we think that, oh, this is just the way it's supposed to be. And I think when you look even at health, there's a lot of negative health impacts of being kind of in the same rut day after day after day. And when we look at getting older, you can actually look at with neuroplasticity and the fact that doing new things, learning new things, having new experiences, that's actually going to help to create new neural connections in your brain. Conceivably, that could even slow down the potential issues with dementia and Alzheimer's in the future and all that. Like, it's healthy for your brain to do all of this stuff. And at the same time, you may open up the door to these new experiences and new successes that you may have never thought that you were able to achieve.
I couldn't agree with you more. I mean, you're a doctor and you know this better than anybody about neuroplasticity and what it does. And by doing different things and new things, how it tweaks and changes. And I think the problem, like you said, people settle for good enough. They think good enough is good enough. I don't believe that good enough is good enough. I believe that everyone is in charge of their own life and that you have to curate and design the life that you actually want. And that's why my motto is you chase what you want. You don't just take what you get, because too often in times we just take what we get. And, you know, I was an example of somebody that through just doing bold moves, bold things over and over and over again. Did you ever watch, Can't Buy Me Love? You know, it's like He went from totally geek to totally chic, right? Like, And that is life, you know, like you could completely 180 your life in every way possible if you actually take the initiative and do so. And so
outside the box sometimes.
And also realize that no one's coming to save you. You're not going to get that opportunity or get that thing by hoping and praying that someone will do it for you or by visualizing it without action. If you are somebody who believes in manifestation or visualization or all these things, none of it is possible without taking action and hard work. That's the bottom line.
So, I mean, we're encouraging people to basically change things up and to take a bit of a risk. But at the same time, what then is the difference between taking a risk and being bold? Because in your book, you do describe that there is a difference between, once again, taking risks and being bold with your life. What exactly is that difference, and what can people learn about how to be successful trying to avoid risks necessarily, but being bold at the same time?
That's a good question. And why I made the distinction in the book is because I think there's something to be said for calculated risks, but I don't want people to be frivolous and basically, if they have a family of four, go and risk everything when they have to feed a family of four, there's no other income coming in. So when I say a calculated risk and being bold, it's being bold with some kind of like mindfulness of what your situation is, right? Don't throw everything away for a potential of something that's maybe not very possible. I say start small and like work your way up and be smart when you make that bold move. You know, when you're young, right, it's very easy to be bold. It's much easier because you don't have as many responsibilities, right? You don't have people relying on you and depending on you. But when you're young, you can take those risks, right? You usually don't have a family. You're not paying for the roof over your head. You can take these other calculated risks. So I just want people to be cognizant of where they are in life and then act accordingly. You can be bold in one area of your life and not be bold in another, right? So like maybe not quit your job today and pursue your passion of like being a painter and then not have any income to feed your kids. But you know, at the same time, I just think that like you can do a side hustle. You can attempt other things to get you closer to your goal without like burning the house down in certain situations. But that's also not to say that using age as an excuse. Like don't say, oh, I'm already 45. So therefore it's too late for me or to have the relationship I want or to have the career I want. It's never too late. So never use age as an excuse or don't use circumstance as an excuse, but be cognizant of where you are realistically and then reverse engineer to get there.
Do you think, you know, one of the things that we have in common is that we grew up in the 80s, and one of the terms that you brought up is being anti-fragile. You know, when we grew up, our parents didn't watch over us all that much, you know. I mean, I get on my bike and I think about it now, you know, I used to collect comics when I was a kid. And I think about it now, there was this guy who was a middle-aged guy who had all these comics that he sold out of his basement of his house. And I remember back when I was like in middle school that I would ride my bike like a mile and a half to his house, go into this guy's basement, look at his comics, then pay him like $5 for the ones that I wanted and then leave. And I think about that now and I'm like, oh my gosh, if my kid who was a middle schooler said, I'm going to ride my bike to some guy's house who I don't know, go into his basement, just the two of us, I mean, it would freak me out. But we lived in a different age. And how do you think that impacts the, you know, millennials or the Gen Z of today? I mean, first of all, if you can explain this term anti-fragile, which I think is a great term, and why it actually was better for us, I guess, to be this kind of anti-fragile, and how is it impacting the kids of today?
You know, I'm going to give you a stat that will, it will stagger your brain. Okay. Do you know in 2024, right? Do you know that there was 30% of people wanted to take their parent to a job interview? They couldn't go alone. They could not go alone. Okay. So the opposite of anti-fragile is what we have now. And what that's called is a coddle culture. We have a culture here where everybody's coddled. Canceled, right? Like, God forbid you say something that is out of, you know, that's not PC or you insult somebody. Everything is about body positivity. You can't have even the hot, beautiful girl that used to be on the cover of Sports Illustrated swimsuit. Now you have to have a different body type because you're like insulting somebody else. Like, everything is now under this like guise of, in like body positivity, inclusion, or potentially hurting or insulting somebody.
In case somebody gets offended.
Exactly. And the truth is, that is really not how life really works, right? In life, you have winners, you have losers, you have people that like this. There's no such, like, now it's all about participation trophies. I think what that does, it doesn't build mental toughness. It doesn't build grit and resilience. And to be successful in life, the number one quality that you need is grit. Number two is resilience. Usually they're tied. And what we're raising now, and what's becoming the norm and the usual, are very, very sensitively to a crazy place, like emotionally sensitive humans that can't cope. They can't socialize with social media. They're unable to even get a job without feeling like if they were failing. It's really become like an epidemic. And I believe that how we were raised, it gave us a mental strength. It gave us the ability to persevere, be tenacious, be resilient. And if we continue on this path of being coddled, it's like the demise of our society. It really is.
Yeah, I feel like, this is something, you know, for me, I live in a nice suburb of Detroit. I've got two kids. They're in high school, and we live in an affluent community. And this is something that's always been on my mind is with my kids now. My son's 18, my daughter's 16. And that was something that I always wanted to make sure is that they never felt that they never felt that everybody was going to take care of them and that they had a drive to succeed and to go on their own and to make their own lives. And the one thing I worried about for a long time was, do they have resilience? You know, are they going to be able to survive through tough times? Because they've never worried about having food on the table, like being safe that's, you know, we're going to lose our house or somebody's going to break into our house or anything like that. And one thing actually that was interesting is that with the pandemic, in some ways, you know, there was a lot of bad that came out of it. Obviously, it was a tough time for so many people. So many people died and everything. But in my family, one thing that I've realized was that I do think it helped teach my kids resilience, is that they went through a period of time that was difficult and they saw how mom and dad reacted during this time, you know, and there's a lot of people who reacted very poorly during that time, or it was, you know, you're hoarding things so that nobody else can get it, you know, so, but how do your parents react to it? And then how do they react to it? And they become resilient because there are hard times for them. And I think that in some ways going through that, when I look at it, it was a very positive thing in that it taught them that they can go through hard times and get through it and be okay on the other side. Now, I know that there are some people who've had horrible things, you know, there's a suicide rate went way up and all that type of stuff. But if they got through it, I feel, and my kids did, that in the end, it was actually a very good thing that hopefully someday they'll look back and they'll actually feel proud that like, hey, we went through it and I came out fine on the other side. And this is what I learned, is that I'm resilient. So, I mean, I totally agree.
Also, how do you know success if you don't have failure? How do you know, how do you have happiness without having misery? I feel like everything needs the yin to the yang, right? Otherwise, number one, I find it to be, if everything is just always, if you don't have to work for something and everything is taken care of for you and you don't have to like put in any effort. I also think that also plays on someone's self-esteem. And I think that without self-esteem and self-confidence, it's really hard to go after certain things. And it starts when you're young. And, you know, the feeling of being competent breeds confidence. And the only way to feel competent is to do hard things and to get through them, is to follow through, say you're going to do something, do it. That's how you build competence to get to confidence.
And that's interesting, because one of the things you brought up in your book was the positive power of negative visualization. And this was something that I found interesting because I do this all the time. And really the idea is that, you know, you mentioned earlier that kind of smart people, actually in your book, you mentioned smart people tend to overthink things. And that can be actually a detriment to them. And one of the things you recommend is the power of negative visualization, in which case you're visualizing all the negative things that can happen. Now, I'm a surgeon, and I'm going to tell you, Jen, one of the things every time I operate, I always think about, first thing, number one, is what's the worst thing that can happen if I perform this operation on this patient? And of course, number one worst thing is a person can die. And so we think, okay, how do I prevent that? And we do all this testing and stuff to prevent that. And the second thing is, how do I prevent then the horrific complications other than that? And I go into surgery as always with that first on my mind, not first on my mind as how do I, you know, make the scar look a certain way? No, it's like, how do I prevent bad crap from happening to my patient? And that's really served me very well as a surgeon, I think, with my outcomes and all that. But in some ways, you mentioned in your book that maybe that's not such a good thing, because I'm focusing also on like preventing all the bad things, but not necessarily taking other types of steps. So it's interesting. I'd love to hear just kind of how that works in your head and just with other people, like the positive power of negative visualization. What is negative visualization and how can it be actually healthy and helpful for people?
In the most simplest terms, why negative visualization can work is because things never end up as bad as you think they're going to be. We catastrophize in our heads, like of a situation, like, oh my God, if we try that and it doesn't work, or if we say that, and what's going to happen? And in our brain, we create this scenario that's so horrible and so awful. And then really in reality, it's never as bad as we actually do. Like, how many nights have you stayed up at night, like tossing and turning for hours and hours, rethinking, overthinking, ruminating, marinating a horrible scenario that can happen with fill in the blank? And then when it actually happens the next day and you have to face that thing, it's like, it's never as bad. And so I think what it does, it kind of reminds us, like, you know what, like whatever we're thinking, it will never be as bad. So that's why you think of all the possible negative outcomes, because when it actually happens, it's never as bad and it's way easier. And if we can remember that we remind ourselves over and over again that nothing will ever be that catastrophe. It'll never happen to that level and effect of horror that we think. Maybe it will help us and promote us to actually try whatever those things are. The truth is, my entire message, my entire philosophy is to get people to have the courage tomorrow that they don't have today. Because I've noticed and I've seen through my podcast, through my relationships, through my successes, that like, it's not the most extraordinary people or the most talented of people or the smartest of people that really win at life. It's not. The people that really win at life are the people that just like go after it, shot after shot. There's no real difference between me and you. Like maybe with me and you, because you are a doctor. But I was going to say there is one caveat there, which I'll get into. But what I've noticed is when I talk to all these like super extraordinarily successful people, the only difference really between them and you is that they still made an attempt and they still persisted even when they fell, even when they failed. They kept on trying. They still believed in themselves enough to keep going. The only times these things don't really, like I was going to say, like if you are a surgeon or if you're somebody who's really going for a real academic career path, there's some little snafus in there, right? Because I don't know if I'll get through medical school. That's something I know. So I'll have to like deviate to the next thing. But besides a couple of things, life is your, like basically it is your oyster. You can achieve and do anything you really want to do. And it shouldn't deter you just because you don't think you have the talent, the looks, the brains, the this, the that. Because the truth is the people, like I said, who win at life didn't necessarily have those things either. They were just very tenacious. They had a lot more, they had some more confidence, and they didn't let their self-doubt stop them.
And so you mentioned that, you know, to be successful, you're going to expect that you have to fail. And that's okay. One of the things that you mentioned is a statement, connect the dots that life hands you, but first collect them. So just to repeat, connect the dots life hands you, but first collect them. And you tell a story of Steve Jobs in your book. Can you explain what you mean by that? Connect the dots life hands you, but first collect them?
Yeah, well, I think because Steve Jobs did a speech for Stanford that was exceptionally famous. I don't know if you've ever heard it before. And his speech was really about collecting the dot, like basically connecting and collecting the dots. I think every life experience basically is a dot. And sometimes you don't know how it all plays itself out. But it eventually makes sense and all connects together. Like you may do something today that you may not see it has any value, but you'll only know the value of that thing way down the road when it connects to a different dot and it connects all the pieces. It's kind of like in a different way, you know what transferable skills are, right? Like I've used like this has really been one of my superpowers, right? Like I've really been across the board doing a lots of different careers. I was in the music world. I was in the sports world. I did really well in the health and fitness space. Now I'm in the personal development space. And really what it was is me taking skills I've learned from one area of my life, really, and then applying that to a different career and area of my life. And just because it doesn't maybe seem like it applies for your whole, like for what you want to do now, that's actually not the case. Like everything does connect over time, even if you don't see how it does in that moment. And all those things like what that you've learned from something else could be applied to something that you want to do in the future. If you just think about it, right? Like I learned a lot about sales, like corporate sales when I was working for the Toronto Raptors, which was my first job. And there are certain like very particular skills in what I had to do that served me really well later on in life. But at the time, I'm like, what do I need this for? It's so stupid. I don't like this job. But it actually taught me determination, right? It taught me like also how to deal with like corporate politics, right? I had to do with a lot of corporate politics, which then taught me a lot of like navigating like people skills in corporate situations. People like sometimes are very short-sighted of what they're doing and poo-poo those things. And I think that's a mistake.
Yeah, and I think you're right. It's like every step that you take in your life, you think sometimes that you're taking a detour and you're going the wrong direction. But oftentimes when you look back on it years down the line, you realize just how important that step was, or sometimes how important that failure was, because how much you learn from it and you make yourself a better person. 100% hear you. I see how that's happened in my own life, where I've had disappointments that at the time have been just devastating. And then later on, you actually are thankful for them because of what you've gotten from that. You know, either maybe you learn that wasn't the direction your life should have gone, and you're so happy that it went in the other direction, or maybe you learn that this is something that you can take from it that will make you a better person on your next try. So I 100% agree with you on that. Do you have, you know, I know throughout your career, you've had people, you know, I know on social media that you have helped out through your book you have, but I know you've mentored people as well on a more of a personal scale. Is there somebody that comes to mind from your standpoint that you have helped, you know, throughout your career that has really done well for themselves and that you're kind of take pride in, that, you know, you helped to change your life and maybe help somebody who is now in a great place that was aided by your advice?
I would say a lot. I mean, listen, I don't want to toot my own horn, right? Like, yeah, I've helped a billion people. What I provided for a lot of people was the power for them to feel like they have the power within themselves. And I do that by example. I do that with my daughter, who's only 8, now turning 9 years old. I think giving people the tools to know what's possible and taking that initiative. You know, the whole idea of being bold, asking for what you want. Again, I've done that a lot by example. I'm very bold. I ask for what I want. And just by me showing that, people have started to do that in my life. And like my daughter's an example. A lot of other people I've worked with are examples where it's a ripple effect, right? Once you start acting differently and standing up for what you want and doing what you want and asking for what you want, doors open to you, and then opportunities happen that you otherwise would never even knew existed. It takes you down an entire trajectory. It's like the sliding doors effect, right? Like you can go take this door or you can take the other door. And when you're open to opportunity, and when you teach people to be open to opportunity and look at something differently and reframe, I think what I do a lot is get people to reframe how they otherwise would look at a situation or how they would otherwise respond to a situation and then act accordingly. And because of that, it's been the ripple effect. And I've done that a lot in my life, business-wise, family-wise. I mean, people in my life. I mean, listen, I've known it. I see it. And not to like pat myself on the back, but I do think that if anything, if I'm a vehicle or a catalyst for someone to do that, I'm here for it, really.
Why is it you're saying ask for what you want? That was one thing that I found interesting. It's not get what you want. It's ask for what you want. Is that something that you thought about specifically? Because asking, you know, when the way that your book is, you know, it's about being bold. It's about taking chances. It's about upending kind of the staid mentality of staying in your lane and being what everybody expects you to be, or living down to the expectations of others. Why is it ask for what you want? Shouldn't it be get what you want, or go out there and get what you want, or something like that?
Right. That's very astute of you. I'm not surprised you would ask the question like that, but it's true. It is ask for what you want, because I'm not saying, and I don't want to give people these pie in the skies that you will get everything in life, but I will promise you that if you ask for what you want, you will be that much closer to actually getting what you want. Right? Versus not asking and just acquiescing and accepting what is given to you. That's the clincher, right? Is to not just accept what's in front of you, but to ask for what is exactly what you want, big or small. And the other part of that is a lot of times we don't even know what we want, right? But if we ask for what we think we want, it will at least lead us down a path that's much closer to living the life that we actually want. And so that's why I say ask for it, not just accept. And that's why I created, I think, this whole thing of this 10% target, which is really what went viral, which is this idea, this 10% target mindset, which is this philosophy that you need to make 10 attempts at whatever you want most. Not one attempt, not two attempts, but 10 attempts. Now, the truth is most people don't make one attempt. Almost nobody makes two attempts. So if you're somebody who's out there with the idea that you're going to be, you have to make 10 attempts, you just on pure volume alone, your chances of getting to that thing go up 1,000-fold. But more than that, you're working under an ideology that you know you have to go after these 10 things. So if you fail, your mind is already primed for that, that you will fail and then try again, which is giving you the practice of resilience and failing. And the truth of the matter is you may not get to that thing, but another opportunity will present itself that you never
knew existed.
It's
like I needed this, I think, when I was in college, because I would go out to the bar and I would ask one girl to dance and then she would say no. And then my night was over and I'd hang my head in shame and go home. And then I had friends of mine who would practice your 10% approach, where they would ask 10 girls to dance and one of them would say yes, and they would have a great time that night. So
exactly.
I wish I would have read
but
your book back then.
But it's 100% true. I know, right? You know, can I tell you, the funny thing is so many college students loved my book because of these things, and salespeople, because it teaches you, like, you know, not take no for an answer. And if they don't, like, sometimes it's not just asking, it's emailing, it's networking, going through another friend. It's about, there's a lot of different ways to make 10 attempts. It's not just the obvious, like, ask. That's the first one. And then you can think of other ways.
One of the big things I think that people can really take from your book, I think, is really well done. And it's the three F's. So you give out the three F's. It's fix it, farm it out and forget it. And this is something that I, even though I've been, you know, I feel like I've been doing this throughout my life over the last maybe 10 to 15 years after I've gotten successful in my career and everything. And I feel like it's something that a lot of people can really be successful in life overall by following these three rules. So can you explain what it means to fix it, farm it out, or forget it?
Yes, because I think a lot of times we get stuck in this purgatory of what to do, right? And so a lot, like, for, I'm going to use an example. Like, I think I put this in the book about my nose, right? I hate my nose. I think I asked you about my nose a million times. Like, so what am I going to do about it? Am I either going to fix the nose? And I can't really farm out my nose really in that way. Either can fix it or forget about it and just move on with my life, right? Like, things fall in certain buckets of life. Like, don't let things get you down and don't ruminate on certain decisions that will, like, just get you down a bad, you know, rabbit hole. I put things in these three buckets, right? If you don't like something, what are you going to do about it? Are you going to fix it? Or if you can't do, and the reason why I put the farm it out is if you can find somebody to help you with it, then do that. So either you're going to fix it, you're going to farm it out to someone who can help you. So then you're not dealing with it, or you're going to forget about it and not worry about whatever that thing is and move on with your life. And that way, when you have these buckets, it like stops the analysis paralysis of what we do with ourselves. We tend to like overthink, overanalyze, and then we end up doing nothing, sitting there wondering back and forth with the rumination. Rumination is a killer, right? It's like a slow death.
Paralysis, decision paralysis.
Yeah. And it's like, it takes up a lot of space in your brain and time. And like, it's like that nagging thing that just won't go away. So if you can, like I said, if you can figure out what bucket something falls into and then act accordingly, it just saves a lot of time and energy and like, and just quite frankly, just like anxiety.
Yeah. My guest this week is Jennifer Cohen. She's got a book called Bigger, Better, Bolder. Live the life you want, not the life you get. I would strongly encourage you, if you're looking to change up your life, if you want really a lot of what we talked about today is how you be bold and how being bold can actually change your life and point your life in the right direction for you. So that, you know, I mean, I'm 51 now. I can't believe it. And I look back and I'm like, do I have any regrets? Should I have done something differently with my life? This will help prevent you from looking back and saying, geez, maybe I should have been more bold. Because that truly, I agree with Jen that that is the path to success, not just, I think, in your career, in kind of a more of a work sense, but also in a personal sense as well. So would strongly encourage you to take a look at the book, Bigger, Better, Bolder by Jennifer Cohen. How do people find you online?
Well, they can go to Instagram, of course, at therealjencohen.com. They can go to jennifercohen.com and just, you know, subscribe to my free newsletter. They can listen to Habits and Hustle, which is my podcast.
Yes. So thank you so much for having me on a few months ago. It was a lot of fun.
Oh my gosh. A pleasure. And you know, all the things, all the same things that we all do. Instagram, TikTok, you know, all of it.
I always ask my guests one final question at the end of every interview. If you can give one final piece of advice for our audience, what would that be? Jen Cohen, author of Bigger, Better, and Bolder.
I'm going to say, if you're scared, do it anyway. If it's inconvenient, do it anyway. If you don't have time, do it anyway. My point is, do it anyway. Even with working out, if you don't feel like it, you do it anyway. That's how you actually become disciplined. It's not about motivation. It's become discipline. It's about getting discipline, and it's about going. And once you learn that you can do it anyway, even if you're not ready, and that's how you will actually win at life.
Well, thank you. Thank you so much for joining me today, Jen. This was a lot of fun.
Thank you for having me.
So my name is Dr. Anthony Yoon, and I'm known as America's Holistic Plastic Surgeon. This is the Holistic Plastic Surgery Show. If you've been enjoying this podcast, if you could leave a rating or review on iTunes, it definitely helps me spread the word. And as usual, always remember to eat real food, use clean skincare, and auto-juvenate before you operate.
Do collagen supplements work? Yes, they do. There have been many studies, some with over 1,000 participants, which have shown that taking a daily hydrolyzed collagen supplement can be beneficial to the collagen in your skin. Now, our skin is composed about 70 to 80% of collagen, and we tend to lose about 1% of the thickness of collagen every year. So what can you do about it? Well, in addition to eating healthy sources of protein, you can take a hydrolyzed collagen supplement every day, like my Yoon Beauty Supplemental Collagen. It's made with the highest quality bovine collagen peptides, is taste-free, and easily dissolves into hot drinks, like coffee, tea, or water. It can also be blended into a smoothie or a smoothie bowl. There is absolutely no beefy taste here, my friends. Check out our Yoon Beauty Supplemental Collagen at yoonbeauty.com and use the coupon code PODCAST to get 15% off your first order. We'll have a link in the podcast caption below.